Lisboa, Bruxelles, Berlin, Warszawa.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. Hello and welcome to The Europeans, the show where we nerd out about this delightful, confusing, and occasionally functional continent we call home. I'm Dominic Kramer in Amsterdam and I'm speaking to Wojciech Oleksiak in Warsaw.
Hi.
You're just back from Italy. Bentornato.
Yeah.
How was it?
Italy was awesome. Me and Kaz were invited to speak at the Internazionale a Ferrara. And this is a festival organized by a magazine, Internazionale. And we just felt like it's a parallel reality. People were so engaged. They were queuing in like massive long queues to get to a room where journalists would talk about their work. We would be stopped at streets saying, "We appreciate your work. That was so interesting. Thank you for doing this." And Kat was like, "And then in 2 days, I'm going to be back home and no one's going to care. And no one's going to tell me I'm doing a great job. And how am I going to survive?" But it felt like a dream, really. Amazing festival. Go if you can.
Sounds like the vitamin shot that we all need in early October. And I was wondering, did you notice anything of this general strike for Gaza whilst you were in Italy?
So I came pretty late and the strike was almost over when I came. So it wasn't that visible for me. But I know Kaz was stuck in the traffic for like 3 hours. And also, you know, we talked about this in the afternoon and in the evening with people. And it seemed like they were really proud that this happened. And it made us very proud that, you know, Italians, they decided that if the Sumut Flotilla was to be stopped, they would just block entire country. And they actually did. Everybody stopped working. And, you know, the country just was held to a standstill to show that they do not support how the government of Giorgia Meloni is reacting towards what's happening in Gaza. And I think it's really beautiful. It's such a grassroots initiative and it was really statewide.
From what I've read, it was called for by the unions.
Yeah, I talked to Jonathan Zenti, this great producer who invited us, and he said that actually it started from two small unions. So it wasn't like a, you know, a massive consortium of all the biggest unions. It was pretty like grassroots. People really had enough and they wanted to tell it and show it to their government and to the world. So impressive. Democracy in practice.
Well, this is not going to be the only chatter about protests this week. One of the things we're not going to be talking about on this week's show is the latest crisis in the French government. If we talked about all these crises, I think this would just very quickly become a podcast solely about French prime ministers resigning. Because where are we at? I think 5 French prime ministers since the start of 2024, yeah. And soon maybe a 6th. But what we are going to be talking about is the results of the Czech elections, which took place last weekend. You may have seen that former prime minister, a self-described Trumpist, the billionaire Andrej Babiš, came out on top, and he looks like he will become prime minister once again. Later on in the show, we'll be joined by Czech journalist Kateřina Šafaříková to find out what this election means for the Czech Republic, for Europe, and for Ukraine. But first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Who's had a good week, Dominic?
I'm giving a tentative good week to the cultural sector in Lithuania after they mobilized incredibly quickly, protesting against the appointment of a new culture minister from a political party with some pretty shocking views. And within a matter of days, the new minister had to step down.
Yay. People power sometimes works, not only in Italy.
Yeah, indeed it does. And look, you might think, why am I talking about the Lithuanian culture ministry? But it's what we like to do on this podcast sometimes. Zoom in on a political happening that, unless you're living in that country, you probably haven't heard about it. And I think it's really important to shine a light on what is happening with this new cabinet in Lithuania?
Yeah, actually, I talked about it in Ferrara, and I think it's really important. And, you know, like, I live only about 3 hours drive from the Lithuanian border, but I don't really know anything about the new government. Like, what I know is that they had elections last year,
yeah,
and then there was this corruption scandal. The prime minister resigned, and that's all about I know.
Yeah, exactly. That's what happened. There is now a new prime minister from the same Social Democratic Party that won that election in November 2024. It's a political newbie, former trade unionist Inga Ruginiene. And her cabinet was sworn in on September the 25th. And she's in coalition, as was the case with her predecessor, with this centre-leftish Greenish party and a populist nationalist party called the Dawn of Nemunas. And yeah, the inclusion in the cabinet of that populist party has caused quite some international and domestic backlash, particularly for the concerns around the guy who leads the party, Remigius Gemataitis. Only a few years ago, he actually had to resign from parliament after making anti-Semitic statements online. Yeah, and so this cabinet is like a new cabinet with some old faces in it. But one of the changes that the new prime minister has done is that she's decided to give members of this populist party, Dawn of Nemunas, two actual cabinet seats. Last time, they merely endorsed three independent ministers. So the party was given the Ministry of the Environment and the Ministry of Culture. But actually,
culture?
I guess some people think, oh, Ministry of Culture, that's just where a lot of fluff happens. But actually, I think this might have been an oversight. Initially, they were actually meant to be given the Ministry for Energy, but they struggled to fill that post. And then last minute, they agreed to swap with the Social Democrats. And the Populist Party took the Cultural Ministry, even though that wasn't what was in the coalition agreement. And that's exactly why the cultural sector are so annoyed about this in Lithuania, because it's as if saying, oh, you're just culture, it doesn't matter. Whereas actually, as we've talked about on this podcast many times, like, culture, soft power, it's all such an important part of society. And yeah, it's been taken as a bit of a slap in the face by the cultural industry, as if it hadn't been thought through properly by the prime minister what the consequences would be of having a culture minister with, at least according to some observers, pro-Russian leanings. And so the person who was appointed Minister for Culture was someone called Ignotas Adomavičius, the founder of a frozen food pasta company. Someone who probably knows his shit about pasta.
Sorry. A what?
A pasta company.
Okay.
Frozen pasta. So he's someone who probably knows his shit about pasta, but he was seen by the cultural sector as totally unqualified for the position of Minister of Culture.
But did he have any experience in culture beyond pasta? I mean, pasta, well, in Italy, pasta is definitely culture. It might even be a form of art, but
yeah,
is it culture in Lithuania? It's frozen pasta.
Is pasta culture? I think that's a topic for another episode, Wojciech.
It is.
Too big
it
a
is.
Question for me to answer today. But no, as far as I can tell, he had no experience in the cultural sector. He did play trombone and sung at high school and even dabbled in choral conducting. But that was all as a child at high school. And the only thing I can see that he's done culturally as an adult is that he appeared on the TV show The Voice of Lithuania. You know, this TV show, The Voice, that they have in like every country where people sing and the judges have their back to you and their giant swivelly chairs only turn around if they think the singing is impressive.
So did the judges press the big button and swivel their chairs around?
No, they did not. It's actually quite a painful vocal performance. I think we probably can't play it for rights reasons, but I wish we could. Go and look it up. I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes. In my humble professional opinion, it's not good. And the judges on The Voice also decided it wasn't good, so he didn't go through to the next round. And I mean, even if they had turned their swivelly chairs around, does appearing on The Voice as an amateur singer qualify you to be Minister of Culture? The Lithuanian cultural sector certainly thinks not. And yeah, once his name was put forward as a candidate for culture minister, a petition took off almost immediately. It gathered tens of thousands of signatures. It questioned his competence for the job and condemned what it called the populist, pro-Russian and anti-Semitic rhetoric of his party. The protesters are reported of saying that they're worried his appointment could threaten freedom of expression, media independence and even the country's democratic values. But despite clear opposition from the cultural community, he was approved by the president's office and officially became minister on September the 25th. Interestingly, the president had rejected two other proposed ministers from the dawn of Nemunas party. But with what he called a heavy heart, he allowed this cultural ministry appointment to go ahead. I imagine both the government and the president were kind of caught off guard by how quickly and powerfully the cultural sector mobilized. There was a flurry of resignations and boycotts after Adomavičius became Minister of Culture. To name just a few examples, the European Film Festival, Scanorama, said that they would reject the patronage of the president due to the confirmation of Adomavičius' nomination. A number of other cultural institutions announced they would not be cooperating with the office of the president. So yeah, the president's really being targeted, even though the president doesn't actually appoint ministers, they just approve it. But also big cultural institutions like the Cosmos Theatre and others said they would be cutting certain ties with the culture ministry. The Lithuanian Literary Translators Union, for example. And the nine members of the culture ministry's Literature Council all resigned en masse. This is just the tip of the iceberg. There were also protests erupting in the streets. It's that thing I've said before on the show, when state support for culture is under attack, governments should not underestimate how effective artists are at protesting. They're just so good at it and come up with good slogans, really nice banners, and they've just got a lot of energy. In this case, it worked. Adomavičius resigned on his ninth day in the job. The final straw came when he didn't give a clear answer to a journalist's question about whether he considers Crimea to be Ukrainian or Russian. He claims he only stepped down due to threats and pressure on his family. But yeah, I don't really buy that. We also know that the prime minister urged him to resign.
Yeah, classic. Well, a great victory for the cultural industry in Lithuania. Like, look, just some determination and unity and we can do everything.
It's true. I honestly found it quite inspiring to see. And that's also why I wanted to talk about it, to remind us that it's not hopeless. Like, we should protest and push back against these nationalist populists. But yeah, I should say the cultural ministry are not letting their guard down. He resigned last Thursday, and by Sunday, there were already more protests, actually the biggest protests yet, in Lithuania, that took place all across the country. And these protests were against the plans to replace him with another nominee from his party, the Dawn of Nemunas, at the culture ministry. As of Tuesday morning, it looks like that party still intends to put forward its own candidate for the vacant post. And actually, that might have happened by the time you're hearing this. But these protests on Sunday were really big. The organizers named it a warning strike. And it happened, as I said, all across the country. Euronews reported hearing chants of, "We will not allow pro-Russian populists to take culture hostage." And though the protests took place across the country, they all synced up at 2 p.m. with a performance of a symphonic poem by Lithuanian composer Čiurlionis called The Sea, which has kind of become the anthem for these protesters. It was played simultaneously by three Lithuanian symphony orchestras and streamed across the country and at expat gatherings all around the world. The organizers of the protests say that there will be more protests if the government doesn't listen. And their goal is not only to take the culture ministry away from this populist party, but to not even give that party an option of proposing one of these independent non-party members as a minister like they did in the last cabinet.
Do you think the government will listen?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. Prime Minister Rudin Yena is a newbie and quite inexperienced in politics, but apparently has a reputation as a consensus builder. So We'll see if she finds a way to please both her populist coalition partners and the cultural sector. It's certainly going to be a challenge ahead for her. But for now, I'm giving the cultural community in Lithuania good week. And before I move on, I'd like to thank our listener, Gabriella, for bringing this story to my attention and also for helping me with some local nuance about Lithuanian politics. I love our listeners. But I guess it's time to move on to bad week now. Who's had a bad week, Wojciech?
Dominic, it really hasn't been a good week for Georgia's democratic opposition. Have you seen the images from the October 4th protests?
Yeah, I have. It looked pretty dramatic. Like there was some pretty horrible pushback from the police.
Yeah, so also I think I owe everyone a quick recap. I feel like what's been happening in Georgia over the past several months hasn't had much coverage in Western media, and I'd like to give everyone some context, if that's okay with you.
Yes, good idea.
So very quickly, back in October 2024, the pro-Russian Georgian Dream Party, led by billionaire Bijina Ivanishvili, claimed a decisive victory in parliamentary elections. And both the domestic and international observers said that the vote was most probably rigged, that it was just a fraud.
Can you just remind us who this billionaire Ivanishvili actually is?
Yeah, he's a very interesting figure. So, basically people in Georgia often say that he more or less owns the country and runs it like his own private company, one of his many private companies. I came across this crazy stat the other day. His personal wealth is estimated to be about a quarter of Georgia's entire GDP.
Wow.
He's by far the most wealthy person in Georgia.
That is not right.
No.
Why does anyone need to have that much money? And yeah, where does all that money come from?
Yeah. He's kind of a usual post-Soviet oligarch, really. He made his fortune in Russia during the wild years after the fall of Soviet Union. That was a murky, chaotic time when fortunes were made mostly on privatizing those ginormous state companies. Like, you know, you could probably cheaply buy the whole energy sector in 1991. Fast forward to 2024, when he decided to rig the elections, massive protests broke out almost immediately, and just as quickly came the crackdown. And I know it sounds like a cliche, but actually in this case, the brutality was really, really shocking. Any person going to a protest couldn't be sure they'll come back home safe or at all. People were dragged out of their beds at night, rounded up and heavily beaten, like really heavily beaten, and for most of the time for protesting peacefully.
Yeah, people should go back and listen to our episode from that time when we spoke to Anna Gavarishvili, an amazing Georgian journalist who witnessed it all firsthand.
Yeah, Anna's work is absolutely invaluable. She's still reporting on what's happening there, and her coverage obviously helped me prepare for this update too. Back to the protests. Over time, they have lost some momentum because the crackdown was so severe, but they never stopped entirely. Every night, for more than 300 days, people have gathered on Rustaveli Avenue, one of the Tbilisi's main streets, to show that they haven't accepted what happened, that they still want Georgia to move toward the EU rather than slide back into Moscow's orbit.
Yeah, I mean, officially, Georgia is an EU candidate country, right? That feels a bit like a distant memory. That's not happening, right?
No, not really. The current government is definitely not interested in any talks with the EU. And the European Commission officially halted the procedure for very obvious reasons last year. So it's not like their status is revoked indefinitely, but it will definitely require a change of the government to resume it, most probably.
Okay.
And speaking of changing people at the helm of things, that brings us to October 4th. So it was supposed to be just a round of local elections. You know, normally it's a kind of a lower stakes affair. But this time the regime treated it like a referendum on its often questioned legitimacy. And they started preparing early in their ways. So months before the vote, Georgian Dream passed new laws that made it much harder for the opposition parties to register or receive funding, including funding from abroad. Later, they de facto blocked independent election observers. And I'm not even mentioning Georgian prisons being full of opposition leaders at the moment.
So it's definitely not a level playing field in terms of elections.
No. So in response, most of the opposition decided to boycott the elections altogether. They just didn't want to take part in something that clearly wasn't a real election. Only two smaller opposition parties joined in, but meanwhile, something else was brewing in the background. So one of the opposition figures, a famous opera singer named Pata Burchuladze, declared October 4th a day of peaceful coup. In an interview published on the eve of the vote, he said, quote, "We will adopt a declaration, take power back into our hands, and send the usurper Ivanishvili home with his wealth. This day should be and already is historic," end quote. Sending Ivanishvili home means sending him back to Russia. He has very, very strong ties with Russia.
Okay.
So remember the name Pata Burchuladze. He'll come back in a moment. He's your colleague after all.
Well, and as I said, don't underestimate artists with their abilities to protest.
Oh, yeah. So the results came in and no one was surprised. Georgian Dream swept all 64 districts, including Tbilisi, a stronghold of an anti-authoritarian opposition. The one bit of good news: turnout was historically low, around 40% and barely above 30% in Tbilisi. So at least the regime didn't get the legitimacy stamp it wanted.
Are those turnout numbers reliable?
Actually, I found it really hard to determine. They're official, but also mostly consistent with the independent estimates, but no observers were there. So I'm not sure like what the estimates are really based on. If they are solid, the turnout was about 15% smaller than in the previous local election. So that can give you a sense of how efficient the boycott campaign was. And back to the protest. That evening, protesters again filled Rustaveli Avenue, this time in much larger numbers than every night. And that's when Burchuladze, the opera singer, took to the stage, declared that power now belongs to the people, and asked the crowd to vote on it by raising their hands.
Oh, wow. That sounds nicely theatrical and a very bold move. But did he mean it literally?
Yeah, I think there was no theater there. He was absolutely serious. And he then went a step further and urged the crowd to take over government buildings one by one and called on police to stand down. Some protesters tried to march on the presidential palace. They tried to get in and fight the police, but they were very quickly repelled. They were very unprepared for that. Several people were injured on both sides, some severely, and by morning, dozens were in hospital or under arrest. Five opposition figures, including Burchuladze himself, were charged with, among others, attempting to overthrow the government, charges that can carry up to 9 years in prison.
That's very grim.
Yeah, it is. Also, Burchuladze was hospitalized after getting poisoned with tear gas, and he's now facing a trial. There are concerns among commentators that this can turn into a show trial.
You told me yesterday this wouldn't be a completely bleak, bad week. Is there any silver lining?
Yes, there is. And the silver lining is that the Georgian people haven't given up. It's been nearly a year since their country took a sudden turn toward authoritarianism and Moscow. And still, every night they gather, they march, they sing. Despite the fear, despite the arrest, they just keep showing up. And this week's protest, even with all its chaos and that ill-advised attempt to storm the presidential palace, it was a powerful reminder to all of us that they're not ready to let go of their democratic dream.
And I mean, I did see some coverage of these protests, but I'm a total European news nerd. So I don't really have a sense of how much coverage these protests got internationally.
In Eastern European media, it was front page news almost everywhere. In the West, a bit less, but you'd have an article on the front page in most of the outlets. And I think that this visibility really, really matters. If the international community forgets about Georgia, the way we more or less forgot or decided that Belarus is a lost cause, the opposition's fight becomes impossible for many, many reasons. And that's what the protesters are asking from us, to keep talking about it, to remind the world that the last year's election was stolen, that even if Georgian Dream has some genuine support, because they do, it's nowhere near the overwhelming majority the regime claims and holds on to.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's also kind of why I'm talking about the Lithuanian protests now. It's obviously a completely different situation and things are so much worse in Georgia, but the people in Lithuania are protesting so that it doesn't end up being where they are in Georgia, to kind of put it bluntly. And we have to keep our eyes as the international community on all these protests, however difficult it is. But before you stop talking about Georgia, Wojciech, I know there's like a lot of misinformation regarding Georgia on social media platforms. And do you have any tips or like a list of the profiles of Georgian journalists you trust so that our listeners could follow them and stay informed?
Yeah, obviously. I'd be very happy to, or delighted to. There are accounts and journalists I've followed for years, and I can guarantee they're super legit and very accurate. So I'll be more than happy to make a list, and you'll find it in the show notes. Welcome to the segment of the Europeans podcast where we tell you what it's like to run a small independent outlet and why it simply wouldn't be possible without your support. Today I wanted to give you a quick peek behind the curtain so you can see why your donations really do mean the world to us. Right now, nearly 60% of our budget comes from an EU grant, and the rest, it comes from you, our listeners, who choose to support us even though everything we make is free and there's no paywall. That big grant is a huge deal for us. It gave us just this a bit of breathing space that helps us to plan ahead instead of constantly panicking about survival, and means we can make more of the kind of stuff you tell us you love. But there's always a but. Grants, they don't last forever. This one runs out in December 2026. By then, we want to be able to stand firmly on our own two European feet. So here's the plea. Please consider joining the very noble ranks of our supporters over patreon.com/European podcast. You can chip in for as little as €3 a month or make a one-off donation through our website, europeanspodcast.com. Every contribution, big or small, helps us. We know it's a big ask. It's not going to be easy to tilt this proportion, but we're feeling pretty hopeful, especially after the amazing response to our recent calls for support. Dominic, can we do some shout-outs for the new supporters who've joined or the ones who upped their pledges since the last episode?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much to Elke, Mark, Sandra, Donal, Zdeněk, Khan, Thierry, Laura, Elisa, TK, and also to Pia, Lynn, and Regan for increasing their donations.
That's a great, great long list. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you all so much. And I should say, last episode, I promised I'd give shout-outs to people who posted about us and tagged us on social media, because the other way you can help us out is by like telling other people about us. And lots of lovely people did that too. So thank you to Anna, to Lydia, Laszlo, Sven, Thierry, Tom, Soa Prout, and special thanks to Andrew for your lovely video on Instagram, and Valentin for your very touching post on LinkedIn. Ooh, and also to Juliette, who is keeping it offline and recommending the podcast to her students in real life. Great idea. I was very touched that so many of you heeded my call for help with promo. So thank you so much. It's time for our interview segment. And this week, this is the segment of the show that is made in cooperation with our radio friends across Europe at Euronet Plus. We had another big election week here in Europe. This time it was the Czech Republic's turn to head to the polls. And the big winner was a familiar face, former Prime Minister Andrej Babiš, an agro-industry billionaire who's such a fan of Donald Trump that he even had his own red baseball caps made. Babiš leads the ANO, or ANO, party, a right-wing populist movement, and they scored just under 35% of the vote. That's more than 10 points ahead of the next biggest party, led by the incumbent Prime Minister, Petr Fiala. Now, 35% is solid, but it's not enough for a majority, so Babiš will need some help to govern. And his probable coalition partners hold even more extreme views than he and his party pals at ANO. It looks like he'll probably be teaming up with the single issue anti-green Motorists for Themselves party and the anti-immigrant Freedom and Direct Democracy party, a party that is considered by many as neo-fascist. Polls had predicted a Babish comeback, but the result still leaves us with a lot of questions. What does this mean for Europe, for Ukraine, and for Czech citizens themselves? What's going to change now that Babish, this man who's regularly compared to Viktor Orban and Donald Trump, is back? But we also wanted to try and work out why voters went for Babish. Not resoundingly, of course, though his is by far the biggest party. I think it's always important to look at like who didn't vote for the biggest party, 65% of people in this case. And even with a high turnout, it was 69%. That 35% of 69% of possible voters works out only at 24% of the total eligible population for voting. So if you look at it like that, it's not exactly a landslide when you zoom out a bit. Do you think I'm hunting for too much of a silver lining, Wojciech?
No, I'm just always get confused with this math. But yeah, I think it's a very important argument to be made about what's the actual proportion of people voting. Although, you know, those who don't vote, they don't have a say.
Absolutely, you're right. But I just think we should not make out like he's been given this huge mandate to do whatever he wants. Still, it's clearly a major political comeback. And to help us unpack it all, we called up the most excellent Czech splainer out there, Kateřina Šafaříková. She heads the op-eds desk at the news outlet Seznam Zprávy. We caught up with her on Monday morning to get her take on what's behind Babiš's return and what could be next for Czech politics. Hello, Kateřina. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's just dive right into it. Andrej Babiš and our party won over the weekend, but they do not have a majority and will need to create a coalition with other parties to form a government. The mainstream political parties of Czech politics have already said that they won't work with him. So what is this new coalition going to look like and how long might it take to come together?
So ANO movement will likely form a majority coalition government with two fringe parties. One anti-migration, very Eurosceptic movement called SPD is actually the Czech proper far-right party. And the second one, it's quite funny, it's called Motorists for Themselves. It's basically, the name of the party is, you know, telling for itself. So it's a party lobbying for cars and no limits on emission on cars, etc. And these three parties should have a majority of 108 mandates in the lower chamber of the parliament, which is just, you know, perfectly enough for them to have indeed majority in the parliament. So that's why they are most likely to form a coalition government.
Okay. And I wanted to ask, before we go further and talk about those parties, what kind of power does the Czech president have? Because that's someone called Petr Pavel. And Pavel comes from a very different political persuasion to Babiš. So is Pavel definitely going to confirm Babiš as prime minister? And is he likely to restrain a new government once a coalition has formed?
Look, the president has a quite significant role in the Czech system, whereas he or she, so basically the president of the state, has the right to appoint the prime minister. And if I say has the right, it's understood within the context of our constitution that he will have to do it. He will have to nominate the leader of the biggest party of the potential government. But still, it's right and not a duty. Hence, the president has already hinted that he might not appoint any ministers, including the prime minister, if he or she would question the Czech membership in EU or NATO.
And is that something that Babiš might be likely to do?
Andrej Babiš will likely to follow suit when it comes to him staying in the EU and in NATO. And we understand that President Petr Pavel is likely to keep to what he's been saying for long, as I just mentioned, that he will indeed not nominate any minister whose agenda is to lobby for EU or NATO exit.
Something that is really interesting to me, observing from across the border, is that recent polling showed that the sentiment against Prime Minister Petr Fiala was stronger than anti-Babiš sentiment. And, you know, Andrej Babiš is a Slovak-born billionaire. He's a suspected fraudster, a key character in Panama Papers. There were so many scandals, you know, related to him being involved in some kind of like corrupt or nepotism scandals. He's a former communist, a former agent of secret police, and someone who could turn off voters in a lot of different ways. So why is the Czech public so ready for change, and why did they want him back?
Well, if I knew the answer to that question, I would not be probably sitting here as a journalist, but, you know, I'll be leading a very successful PR company, and I would be very, very rich comparing to my current situation. But no, more serious. Okay, so the reason why Andrej Babiš is still so popular, he is a result of a collapse of two-party system in the Czech politics already some 15 years ago. And the second reason is that, I know it might sound too simplistic, but he just can connect with normal people. Petr Fiala, the current prime minister, he's a university professor by profession, and he may seem not easy to access, while Andrej Babiš can easily talk about him being treated for colonoscopy a week ago. And so he would like jump in into conversation about colonoscopy with a man he would, you know, he knows for 5 minutes at that very moment. So there is this chemistry that works fine. Plus, I think he led a very good campaign pointing to the weak points of the current government.
You described Babiš as having this great bond with his supporters. And I guess that's maybe one of the reasons why he's often described as the Czech Trump, and also compared to Viktor Orban. But I was wondering, are you satisfied with those comparisons, or do you think they also kind of don't quite paint a full picture?
I think it's quite accurate in a sense that all three men we would just mention as strong men or wanting to be strong men, strong leaders, a very populist, unhinged, I would say, all of the three. Where I would sort of single out a difference is that wherever Andrej Babiš was facing situation where he would be facing a strong opposition, being in the EU circles or NATO circles, he was the first one to retreat. So he's not, you know, a lone wolf ready to fight for the last drop of his blood on his own. No, I think in this respect, he is lesser Trump and lesser Orban.
Ah, yeah. And I saw that you wrote a piece last week where you said you thought maybe Babiš would hide behind Viktor Orban. Is that kind of what you're hinting at here? That
yes. That's correct. When I was following Andrej Babiš as Prime Minister number one, so for the first time when I was a correspondent in Brussels, every time where he could actually hide behind Orban, he did it. Or every time there was a fight where Orban was standing alone, having, you know, 25 roughly against him, and Babiš made this quick calculation, is it worth it for me, like, to step in the fight and, you know, support great Viktor or not? And in most of the cases, the calculation was negative. So that's why he retreated. So that's why the title of my article was that he would be eager to hide behind Orban if it, you know, suits him well. But other than that, he would not be, you know, the bulldog of the EU politics, call it that way.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like a lot has changed since the last time he was in power. It was 2021, so before the Russia's invasion, before Trump's re-election. And it seems like the pack, the anti-EU European pack, is bigger than it was last time. Do you think he might be behaving a bit differently this time? That he might join, you know, the Giorgia Meloni and, you know, all these people who are trying to make Europe a bit more fragmented than we would like to?
His rhetoric has changed since last 2-3 years, since the invasion, also because his electorate, like the bastion of his voters, have shifted. So it's not entrepreneurs anymore, middle class, it's really pensioners and, you know, a lower middle class. So that's one. A second, I think his self-confidence has grown bigger. We could see it on Saturday during the first press conference. So I would see him as being more unhinged, being more tough, maybe a bit to the far right in his words. That's where I see a difference. But I would doubt, as of now, the foreign policy would change a lot. Why? Because he is still someone who really likes to be in the club of the, as we call them, big boys, Macron, Merz, basically, you know, the Western European leaders. He really likes to be in this exclusive gang. He wants to have Macron's mobile and, you know, having him accessible rather than Putin, rather than, you know, Chinese leader, rather than post-Russian leaders. And he knows well, if he wants to be respected by the Western leaders, he has to behave in a way like them. And second, he has business in 16 EU member states. 16. Not a single business in Russia. Not a single business in China. And again, as a billionaire, at the head of one of the biggest agri company of Czechia, and actually the single biggest recipient of EU subsidies of Czechia, okay? I doubt he would put the foreign policy upside down, because then it would be to the detriment of his, I would say, even personal financial interest.
Oh, yeah, interesting that that could be what keeps him buddies with his EU pals. I wanted to talk briefly about the fact that Czechia took in more Ukrainian refugees per capita than any other country in the world. But since then, much of its population and its right-wing parties have turned on those refugees. Why do you think this is? I mean, is it just looking for a scapegoat from the right-wing parties, and or are these anxieties primarily born out of economic strain?
It's economic strain. It's what you call a Ukraine war fatigue. We have this valley, I think, character as a nation, whereas, you know, a valley, ring of mountains around us. And we know that there were some drones over Poland. I mean, I'm talking as a common Czech, right? So we know of the Russian drones above Poland in the Polish sky, but nothing happened really in the Czech valley. Okay, this is still a safe space. So the understanding of the existential threat that Russia poses, it's not so present if you go to Czech pubs, right? So the economic restraints and realities are more important to Czechs, and the party of Tomio Okamura, so SPD, the potential one of the two fringe parties and future coalition parties, he was playing well with the fear or with the unease of most of the Czechs, with the fact that, you know, there are those strangers, foreigners, you know, pouring in, you know, having all the state support. We are entitled to maybe taking our proper jobs, etc. So it's all a cocktail of small maybe reasons, but altogether is a toxic one that pays well for a party like SPD, the far right.
So if we look ahead to a possible ANO-SPD motorist coalition, ANO made a lot of promises, including to cut taxes, lower the pension age, block the EU's green agenda. What changes do you think we can actually expect that possible coalition to bring to fruition on the domestic front?
I think they will be handing out a lot of money to various groups of the population. So say the austerity or balanced budget is the least worry of Andrei Babiš. He was just like pour billions over Czech population in order to stay in power and in order to keep his popularity. So I'd expect lowering of the energy prices. That might happen. I expect higher wages, which was one of the claims. And I think that would be sort of like the core of Andrei Babiš policy. I think the foreign policy or even educational reform or reform of health system would be really put aside. It would be priority number two or three. But the first one would be really housing maybe, but still wages, energy prices. Sometimes they say the food is too expensive and people say food is too expensive, but I don't actually know really how can you sort of regulate on food prices, since this is a free market economy after all, and you can't really dictate on the prices in, you know, in your retail shops. But that's the ambition.
Although one of the biggest providers of food is probably going to be prime minister.
Yes, it's a good remark. But then again, I could argue, okay, but will he be open to like lesser, you know, the income he has, or lesser the profit by lowering the prices in the shops? I doubt it.
Probably
I also doubt it.
Yeah.
So the final question I wanted to ask you is kind of a semi-personal one or a semi-private one. So you work for Seznam Sprawy, which is an independent media outlet. And in your forecast of what might happen, what we might expect from next Babiš government, you spelled out a somewhat alarming scenario in which press freedom in Czech Republic comes under threat. So do you have any concerns that this might actually happen now?
I have, and thank you for the question, but I don't have it for myself as of working for a private media or private company. That actually this, the biggest private media platform in Czechia, so I think we're quite safe. But when it comes to public media, I will really worry, and I am worried for my colleagues from public media. Why? Because all of the three potential coalition parties, they claim they want to reform public media and have them more under control, basically. How they want to do it, it's put the media, the public media, on the state budget. There's a chapter of a state budget, which is very easily done by regular law. You don't have to have a constitutional majority, for example. You just need a regular law. So it will be very easy to pass in the lower chamber of the parliament. And will the Senate veto it? Will the president veto it? That's remain to be seen, really. But yes, this ambition to put the public media under political control, it's there, it's open, it's shared by the three coalition parties, and it's easily done. So I think there is a worry of media freedom for certain part of media landscape in Czechia.
We didn't have time in that interview, Wojciech, to talk about your favorite party in Czech politics, the Pirate Party.
Yeah, so I think it's kind of a thing in Czech politics where a party starts as a single issue party and then...
Sorry, is just... this the single issue in this case is pirates, is it?
it was internet freedom. There was this moment where there was like quite a lot of pirate parties around Europe because the Pirate Way was about to be closed and they wanted more freedom in the internet. So now the Pirate Party is like the biggest left-wing progressive party in Czech Republic. I was rooting for them and they were polling really low, but eventually they got 9% of the vote, which translates to 18 mandates, which is way more than they had before because they had only four. I was delighted to learn that 15 of these mandates are to be held by women. I wonder how do men feel in this party back at the Pirates Bay?
I mean, I think it's great that there are so many women that are getting elected, and I know that the Czech parliament still has a real shortage of women. It's nothing like 50-50. But I can imagine some of the men are quite annoyed if they've like dedicated their lives to this party and were quite high up on the list in the election.
Yeah, there is some reporting that they are not really comfortable with this.
Yeah.
And also, I think it's a trap that, you know, ambitious left-wing male politicians fall into. It happened in Poland the last time. I know as a fact that there were quite a few male left-wing politicians really upset that they were jumped over by candidates that were lower on the candidates list than them because they were women and everybody was just wanted to vote left-wing women.
Yeah, it happens here in the Netherlands too. It's just the cross that these left-wing feminist political men have to bear. Anyway, thank you so much to Katarzyna for joining us this week and taking the time to explain what these results mean. If you speak Czech, go and read her work at Seznam Sprawy. Time to roll into the Inspiration Station and talk about some culture from Europe. What have you been enjoying this week, Wojciech?
Oh, it's the easiest for me. As a Pole, I really can't talk about anything else this week other than the hottest thing happening in Warsaw these days. Europe's second most absurd musical contest, the International Chopin Piano Competition. Do you know what that is, Dominic?
I actually don't, to be honest, even though I'm a classical musician. The first most absurd is Eurovision, presumably.
Yeah, obviously.
Okay, yeah. So I already love it. Tell me why it's absurd.
So basically, every 5 years, the best young pianists from around the world descend on Warsaw, having already survived a brutal qualification process to take part in this legendary piano showdown. It's an absolute star maker. Some of the biggest classical pianists of our time got their break there. We're talking about names like Marta Argerich, Christian Zimmermann, or the recent winner, Bruce Liu.
Okay, so far it just sounds like a normal piano competition. What's so wild about it?
So first of all, I hate musical competitions in general.
Oh, so do I. I never did them.
I actually did quite a few of them. I was born into a musical family and they were trying to make a classical pianist out of me. I just couldn't stand it. I couldn't understand how can you compete in music. And then this competition, I completely don't understand how can you judge something as subjective as someone's interpretation of a piece written by a man who died of tuberculosis in 1849.
You mean the great Polish composer Chopin?
Yeah, exactly. And then there's the way it's covered. It's absolutely hilarious. It's like, you know, Football World Cup, you've got sports style commentators trying to explain to the audience, to a very general audience, because everybody's tuning in, the finer points of piano technique, you know, articulation, rubatos, finger work. It's this surreal mix of football match and a poetry recital.
Wojciech, this sounds great. I love that this is happening. Why do you hate it? I think this is really brilliant.
So I just really think it's absurd. I don't really like it. I mean, I watched it every time it was there. I also know in person quite a few people who participated, and it's just this massive, massive moment of stress and pressure.
Oh, yeah.
And sudden media coverage around you when you're 19. And then there were a lot of scandals because, you know, sometimes the jury takes very weird decisions and everybody's upset. And then like people's careers can be ruined, but you always can go from zero to hero.
Oh, I imagine it's hell to take part. Yeah, I feel for them.
I'm sure about that. And this is exactly my point here, because I'm not recommending this competition to you.
Oh.
What I'm recommending to you is this a film about the contest. So there is this brilliant documentary called Pianoforte. And it's about the previous edition of the Chopin competition. And it's a gorgeous, funny, absurd, and also heartbreaking look at the world of classical music, at the young geniuses that are trying to make it through this competition. It really gives you a peek behind the curtain of classical music world. I think it wouldn't be that hard to find. I saw it on a few streaming platforms, so probably there are in your countries too. And if not, then wink, wink, VPN, wink, wink, probably you can watch it somewhere.
Naughty, naughty.
Okay, so that's it for me. What have you been enjoying this week, Dominic?
Well, this week I'm leaning on our listenership for my cultural tip. This is one from Pia on our Patreon group. She wanted to recommend Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's new book, Dream Count. She says it's fantastic. Mm. Pia advises that you go in with zero expectations and no spoilers. Don't read too much on where the story is going to take you or what it's about. She says it's really quite a ride. I've read all of Chimamanda's previous books and loved them all, so I'm really excited to read this one too. And I was intrigued to hear from Pia that there is a European context for this book, which is why she shared it with us. Pia says, to place this book in context for the Europeans, one story is a fictionalized take on the events around a real person who is expected to lead a European country. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that really got me intrigued, and I'm definitely going to check it out. Pia says Adichie does an amazing job of humanizing the intertwined female stories, offering a deep, introspective look at a major news story from a few years ago. Go check it out. It's called Dream Count.
Sounds awesome.
Time for a happy ending to close off the show. A wallaby has been on the loose in Berlin.
I have no idea what a wallaby is.
Oh, it's like family with the kangaroo. It's like a kangaroo-like animal. It's a bit smaller.
Okay. So how did this kangaroo-like animal end up being in Berlin?
Yeah, good question. And it's got a weird answer, because apparently the journalist and publishing heir, Jakob Augstein, he's one of the main owners of Der Spiegel newspaper. He apparently owns a wallaby. And somehow that wallaby got out of its enclosure in Berlin Kladau. Augstein thinks that an unwanted visitor got into the wallaby enclosure and like maybe deliberately let the wallaby out. Anyway, it was a bit of a stressful few days. They were searching for the wallaby everywhere. There were rumors that the wallaby had made it all the way over to Brandenburg, which is really quite far away.
It is.
But a few days later, it was spotted in a garden just a few doors down from Augstein's home. The wallaby hadn't actually traveled that far. Some gardeners in that garden spotted it and immediately called the authorities. The local councillor responsible for veterinary issues admitted to the Tagesspiegel, "We don't have that much experience with kangaroos in Spandau." But they called in some experts from the Leibniz Institute who tranquilized the wallaby, gave it a checkup, everything was fine, and returned the wallaby to its enclosure. So it's a very happy ending. The wallaby is back home, and the only person that's a bit annoyed is Jakob Augstein, the owner, who seemed a bit miffed that journalists, both from his own newspapers and rival newspapers, were sent to his house to report on it. Apparently, Der Spiegel even sent one of their top investigative reporters to his house, and he really wasn't pleased. He said in a podcast, like, come on, there are more important things happening in the world, or something along those lines. But Jakob, we need flippant stories sometimes, okay?
Oh, yeah. So rich people having animals that I don't even know the names of. Okay, great. So, my main concern would be, should people be keeping wallabies in Berlin? I guess it's not warm enough for them.
Yeah, I also wondered that, but according to the experts at this Leibniz Institute who organized his safe return, they said that this type of wallaby, they're called Bennett's wallabies, and they're native to Tasmania. Apparently, they say it's fine. The climate and vegetation in Berlin is no problem.
Okay, so you got away with this Jakob Augstein this time.
He did. One happy wallaby and one relieved journalist publishing heir. That's it for this week. And actually, we're going to be off for a week next week. But the week after, we've got something very exciting. It's time for the first episode of our new series, Who Does It Best? That will be landing in your feeds on 23rd of October. I can't wait for you all to hear it.
Yeah, me too. We previewed some of the episodes in Ferrara and the response was really enthusiastic, which gave us a pat on the back. And even though we're very tired because it's been a very, very long and massive process involving many people, we think that is something really good. So we can't wait to share that with you.
Yeah, we're almost there. This week's episode is produced by Morgan Childs and Wojciech Oleksiak. If you miss us next week, you can check us out on social media. Go and see our faces on YouTube, on Instagram, see what we're chatting about on Mastodon and Blue Sky. Until the 23rd of October. Bye.
Ciao.